Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Okay, this first segment will be the one where we welcome and banter, and it'll probably be the first part. So we'll take a pause and just... I'll try not to fuck this up, let's just say, okay? That's my motto. Try not to fuck up. It's like on a cross stitch over my bed. I wake up and I was like, try not to fuck up today, okay?
That's what my dad said to me when he dropped me off at college. He shook my hand and said, don't fuck up.
Yeah. So that happened. This week, the Senate took up a vote on whether the Obama administration should be granted fast-track authority to make trade deals, and it did not go well for the White House. It's the latest twist in the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal tale, and we'll sort out what's happening next. Meanwhile, a horrific train derailment outside Philadelphia has returned the issue of infrastructure upkeep to the fore. But is it fair to pin this tragedy on infrastructure insufficiencies? And more to the point, is it possible to have a conversation about that issue outside the shadow of a terrible accident? Or are we just reeling from crisis to crisis again? Finally, celebrated investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has dropped an alternative history of the Osama bin Laden raid. Only this time out, Hersh is finding himself to be a lot less celebrated. Today, we'll have the first part of a long discussion about the way in which this story was received and how it could impact our relationship with Pakistan. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Laura Barone-Lopez, Zach Carter, and Ali Watkins. And here's what happened first. Welcome back to another week of So That Happened. We were off last week. We hope you didn't miss us too terribly. Today I'm with two of my esteemed colleagues. Sitting to my side is Laura Barone-Lopez.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you. This is Laura's debut.
Yes, it is.
On this.
Premiere, actually.
Her premiere, mm-hmm. Sorry. It was like a big, we threw roses at her as she walked. And
I felt very loved.
We made her stand at the step and repeat. And as you probably have already heard.
Zach Carter.
Not making his premiere on this. But that's okay. That's okay. We lived quite well in the week we were off.
We lived hard, but it's good.
We lived hard. We died young. The reason we were off is because we were having our 10th anniversary celebration. Not the podcast 10th anniversary, God help us, but the Huffington Post 10th anniversary. Thank you all for being a part of this. You are the reason we got to have 10 years doing this nonsense.
And get really drunk on Thursday night.
Yes, we hoisted glasses to you guys.
So thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And then later that night, when we got back, we went to see The Replacements again.
Yeah, which was pretty awesome, too. It had nothing to do with you guys, but, you know.
We thought of you. Children by the millions.
I didn't think of them at all.
Scream for So That Happened. Zach, you realize we've now gone from D.C. to New York to see The Replacements and now gone from New York to D.C. to see The Replacements.
I know, and it's 2015, and we're seeing The Replacements. So, I mean, Who says dreams don't come true?
We're pretty dedicated people, I think.
The world is not a vampire, turns out. It's fine because you get to see The Replacements in 2015.
Correct. Now, I don't know if we'll be able to transition from vampires to TPD. to
well, that's actually a pretty smooth transition.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm the king of smooth transitions. That's what everyone tells me. no one tells me that. So, we've been talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal on this podcast, Ride Along. We've been talking about it at the Huffington Post Ride Along. I think largely to the chagrin of President Barack Obama, who hasn't really enjoyed what we have to say.
He openly says, don't read the Huffington Post on
TPP,
trade.
Yeah.
He openly says that. So You are all rebels for listening to this podcast.
He says things like that. Don't read the Huffington Post on trade. Like the same day he has a blog post at the Huffington Post.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure he understands how new media works, but regardless.
He's kind of old. So.
I guess what can we say about what happened this week in Congress? Big scalp for us, right? Us TPP haters.
In a sense, yes.
So set the stage and let's explain to people what exactly went down this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, Laura, you were there.
I was there. Well, what happened was the Senate was set to proceed to debate on the Trade Promotion Authority bill, which would essentially give the president fast-track authority to, you know, shepherd through these deals like the TPP, you know, once they're negotiated and all put together.
Fast-track, I mean skipping traditional approval every single time.
Given expedited powers to just—
Congress
can't—
the Congress would not be able to amend any deal that he negotiates. Mm-hmm. And it would apply not just to deals that this president negotiates, but also 6 years into the future. Mm-hmm. So the next president, potentially two presidents.
Which is also why, you know, Republicans love it so much. And they were bringing it to the floor on Tuesday. Lose track of my day sometimes up there. And they, Democrats said no. They they said that they wanted to have votes on more bills related to trade, that they wanted specifically something on currency manipulation and on— as Zach knows, on banning imports with forced child labor. And so because of that, they just shut it all down, you know, with the help of Senator Brown and really pushing leadership to do this. And it was a mess up there. I mean, everyone was scrambling. And Senator Orrin Hatch, who helped originally craft this deal out of the Finance
Committee. He was not happy.
He was not happy at all. Yesterday, he was saying he was going to kill somebody. So that was—
he was pissed.
A lively—
he was really pissed.
God.
He was
very pissed.
Okay, that's remarkable because Orrin Hatch is typically a very mild-mannered guy.
But
wow.
he is sort of the like progressive like boogeyman bad guy on trade, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Basically, everything that Orrin Hatch likes on trade is the exact opposite of what, you know, all of the internet freedom people like, all of the environmental groups like, all of the labor unions like, what Elizabeth Warren likes. He is the exact opposite. And so he's really mad that he had to make all these compromises just to get his bill out of committee. And then he got it to the floor and people were like, actually, we really want you to abide by those compromises.
Yeah.
So the issue was that in the committee, they had separated all of the— they'd sort of dumped all of the Democratic, you know, like show votes into a separate bill that was not the Trade Promotion Authority. It wasn't the fast track power.
Right.
And so what that meant is that they could hold a vote on this other stuff that the Democrats liked. And anything that happened to that bill would not affect what happened to fast track. So they could get the fast track that Republicans and the president want without necessarily giving Democrats the stuff that they'd had all these show votes on in the Senate Finance Committee. And so Democrats were like, oh, no, you're going to put this stuff together. And they stuck together and they filibustered and blocked the opening of debate, which, while mostly symbolic, I mean, because the next day they opened debate on it, it was a significant symbol. Because the whole point of sending Fast Track through the Senate was because it was a result of the lack of support that Fast Track has in the House. Mm-hmm. They just don't have the votes to get it through the House. And the idea is if they have a nice, quick, big vote where lots of people come out in support of this thing in the Senate, they sort of run up the score and put a lot of pressure on the House to vote for it. And that didn't happen. Instead, it got filibustered. And it was a pretty big embarrassment for the administration, I think. Josh Earnest having to go around saying, you know, there was a procedural snafu in the Senate.
Which afterwards, everyone made fun of him for using that word. But
it's like, yeah, right. Like, I know this couple, they had a procedural snafu. Now they're divorced. really.
But it was an embarrassment, you know, because this is one of the most divisive issues within the Democratic Party. So many Democrats on this one issue are so defiantly against Obama. And so that, you know, all that coming to a head on Tuesday. And then they did have to work to get the pro-trade Democrats back on their side to then, you know, stay united for the filibuster.
Right.
Because I don't think it was totally known.
They lost
right
Tom
out of
Harper, right? He was the one.
He was the one lone Democrat that voted with Republicans.
He was like, whatever. am I allowed to feel like there's a sense of strange irony that it was the Republican caucus that was largely saying, let's give the president this authority. I mean, am I allowed to feel a sense of irony considering that on a lot of other issues, they're very loath to acknowledge that the president has authority
no,
and extremely averse to him claiming authority on his own?
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, that's right. I mean, the administration has even said it. They're like, it's kind of funny that, yes, they're with us on trade, but then they're, you know, they're backwards on their views on Iran.
Right.
Immigration.
Yeah, immigration.
Hold on. I'm becoming Tom Waits for some reason. I don't know why. Okay. Now everything's fine again. Everything. Continue, Laura. Right. I apologize.
Got your Hanson voice back.
Yeah exactly. Bop.
So, yeah, I mean, they flat out said that, you know, on Iran, they want to take our powers, Obama's powers away. But, you know, on stuff like AUMF and on trade, they want to give him all the authority that he possibly has.
There's a significant Tea Party bloc. It's not the Tea Party bloc that has a whole lot of influence in Washington, right? That's like the Club for Growth, Heritage Foundation.
Right.
The Tea Party group that's backed by, like, really rich billionaires. But instead, the Tea Party group, like the Phyllis Schlafly's of the world.
The Tea Party with the pinky out Tea Party.
Right, exactly.
Hey, boy!
Right.
Hey! Exactly. What does the Chamber of Commerce want today?
Precisely. The Chamber of Commerce and Heritage Foundation are at loggerheads a lot, and they are sometimes at loggerheads.
All right, true. That was a bad example.
With Club for Growth. But the Phyllis Schlafly, you know.
My Queen Elizabeth imitation really ran aground at the end there. I apologize for that.
Yeah.
Well, but continue. Said. Sorry.
But there is this substantial, like, Phyllis Schlafly type block that said, look, you know, we've been – Phyllis Schlafly, for those of you who don't know, is this, like, old school, hardline social conservative from, like, the 70s who was very influential in blocking the Equal Rights Amendment for women in the 70s and 80s. But she still –
Yeah, she's like America's, like, own Harry Potter villain in a lot of ways.
But it's interesting because on the trade stuff, a lot of stuff she says sounds like what progressives say. They say, you know, we shouldn't. We should not be fast tracking this stuff. The Congress should have an oversight role. We don't want the administration making executive decisions. And she also points out that a lot of these things are negotiated behind closed doors with corporate lobbyists. And she's not, you know, she's not a corporate conservative. She's a no gays and like kind of conservative.
I forgot that you've actually talked to Phyllis Schlafly about this.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Got with Phyllis. Yeah.
Yes. And
she was like, get at me, Zach Carter.
Right. And she, you know, she could tell. She knew she was talking to the Huffington Post. And she was like, you know, can't believe I'm talking to the Huffington Post about this. But you know, there is a block of Tea Party Republicans in the House as well who share that view. They say, why, you know, we're against giving the president authority on all these different things. We should be consistent on our executive authority stuff and not grant him additional powers on this. And there are also, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons that people vote against trade power. Some of them, I think, is just straight up xenophobia. But others, I think, are more nuanced economic arguments. And there are a lot of Republicans from states, particularly textile states like North Carolina, that have just been devastated by offshoring and outsourcing over the last few years, or 30 years really, and don't see a whole lot of benefits in their district from this type of economic strategy. So they're going to vote against it, and then basically all of the Democrats are going to vote against it, and they don't have the votes in the House as a result, which is why this Senate drama is so important, because if they can get a big show of support from Democrats and flush all the Democratic objections into some black hole somewhere, then you'll basically get the sort of traditional Republican plus Bill Clinton, in this case, Barack Obama will be standing in for Bill Clinton, majority on trade and the deal will go through.
I still don't know, though, in the Senate if they, you know, the Democrats that are anti-trade like Reid are going to end up voting for it. I don't see them voting for it even when they get these other bills. I mean, Brown has flat out said, I'm still not going to vote for it. Yeah, like you said, in the House, it's going to be a lot harder. Just going around talking to lawmakers yesterday, especially ones within, you know, the Freedom Caucus, which is that conservative faction.
Right.
They're more those lawmakers are not for this. It's very hard. It's going to be really hard for leadership to get all of their, you know, their caucus on board. Right now, just rough estimates, people are saying, you know, it's like probably 170 Republicans that are for it, but that's nowhere near enough. Because
enough.
Then even if you just get 20 Democrats, which is the amount of Democrats that are saying they'd likely vote for it, that still is short.
You're still about 20 votes short.
Yeah. I'm not crazy, though. I have to feel like in times past, especially with the Democratic president, there wouldn't be this kind of resistance to this trade deal. Like, aren't we still talking about this kind of like track toward populism that the Democrats have like put themselves on since the midterm elections?
I think so. I mean, well, this objection on trade has been there since before the midterms.
Sure.
Obama basically shelved this for the midterms for all of 2014 so that it wasn't going to be something that Democrats were going to have to take him on over.
Yeah.
So he sort of feels like, you know, I gave you guys cover in 2014. I don't see why you're being such jerks about this now. Can't you just buckle like you did on NAFTA and everything else? I think the issue here is that the Democratic Party has sort of – they've coalesced on domestic policy on just about everything. There aren't issues where the Democratic Party is divided. Everybody in the Democratic Party basically is on board with gay marriage. Everybody in the Democratic Party is basically on board with immigration reform. Mm-hmm. The one issue is economic policy, and there it's all about the relationship between the Democrats and Wall Street. And if you think of Wall Street not just as like the big banks that torpedoed the economy in 2008, but as very wealthy, powerful people in the corporate universe, then TPP becomes very problematic because it's obvious that it's basically negotiated for Wall Street first, and then to the extent that there are things that benefit everybody else, those are all supposed to trickle down essentially from the benefits that these deals garner for very large corporations. And Elizabeth Warren has been very outspoken saying, you know, that's not the way we should manage economic policy. And the president has basically gone out and said, you know, all of these concerns are bunk. And look, after we turn everything over to Wall Street on this trade deal, we're going to have all these other little labor protections and environmental protections that make sure that Wall Street can't do anything that's too bad. And the Democrats just basically don't believe him. The deal remains classified, so Obama could just release it if he wanted to prove that he's got, you know, the most progressive trade deal in history that he claims to have. And Democrats who've seen it, like Elizabeth Warren, just don't think that's accurate or a fair characterization of what's going on. And I cannot imagine that changing. You know, we've dealt with the sort of narrative on TPP for a long time was that it was NAFTA on steroids. And I think that's a little bit hyperbolic. I think it's more like NAFTA with earrings. And like there are some cosmetic changes to
right.
to this trade deal. But if you look at the way these things are enforced and have been enforced over time, the Obama administration
NAFTA
itself
with a cool tribal tattoo.
Right. this has got, you know, exactly. The Obama administration itself doesn't enforce the existing authorities it has on labor protections and environmental protections. You know, they're still killing labor organizers in Colombia. They're still killing labor organizers in Guatemala. And the administration in Guatemala has taken some sort of token actions, but they're still killing people. They haven't actually resolved anything. It's been like 6 years. Nothing is really happening in Colombia and other countries where there are these existing trade deals with labor standards that the Obama administration could just do something about, but don't.
Where is this going now? I mean, so this has been kind of an epic defeat.
Uh-huh.
But
they're going to vote on.
We move past epic defeats.
They're going to vote on some of the bills today, the customs bill, and then the African trade bill, and then after that, they're going to go straight to the TPA, the Trade Promotion Authority, the fast track.
Right. So
they expect it to pass, and then as soon as the Senate passes it, then the House will be trying to take it up. But if that's – I mean, the vote on TPA in the Senate may not come till next week, probably
right.
won't come till next week because they're not – I don't see them getting it done today. And then the House could take it up next week. They only have one more week before they go to recess. So
and that's a big deal because there's another – the TPP deal is not finished with being negotiated, right? They're still negotiating this deal with like 11 other countries. And there's another round of those negotiations at the end of the month. So the reason that there was this big push to cut some sort of deal to push through this Democratic filibuster, which they did do on Wednesday, was because the administration doesn't want to look like they just got shot down on getting their trade promotion authority right before they go and negotiate. Mm-hmm.
So then the House will try to get to it, I mean, soon. Boehner said yesterday that he wants to. As soon as the Senate acts, he's going to bring it to the House floor. But again, there's going to be a problem with votes. And, you know, just talking to Representative Salmon yesterday, he was saying if that vote was held today, they wouldn't have the votes to pass it. And he doesn't see that happening anytime soon. So it's going to be really hard because it comes down also to not just, you know, the policy of this, but a lot of or a good chunk of the conservative Republicans, you know, don't know if they want to be seen as siding with Obama on an issue. So it's the whole political side to it.
Oh, yeah, that's
it's
true.
It's that whole,
yeah.
you know, stigma of do I vote with him when this entire time I've been saying I absolutely cannot stand him.
He's a socialist monster.
And so there's that. Or do, you know, another lawmaker put it is, or do I get excited because I get to vote like anti-Harry Reid on something?
Good point. You know, Mitch McConnell framed it.
Yeah.
Mitch McConnell framed it by saying that a vote for TPP was really a vote to assist the next Republican president.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's...
which to my mind, I don't know, that then becomes sort of very clarifying for Democrats. I mean, I think that things like that make it a little bit easier for them to hang together after the fact. But maybe Mitch McConnell doesn't give a shit. I don't know.
Well, remember, his job is to get Republican votes, right?
Yeah, so, of course. Yeah,
and so he needs the Chamber of Commerce to basically say, Mitch McConnell, you did good, and thank you, because the Chamber of Commerce, which is the largest corporate lobbying, most influential one in the country, they are almost exclusively a wing of the Republican Party. They donate to like token Democrats, maybe like once a cycle now, but it's really just a fundraising apparatus for the Republican Party. So Mitch McConnell feels a lot of pressure to get Republican votes to show the Chamber, hey, it was a good idea that you stuck with us, because look at all those Democrats, they're going to vote against you. Mm-hmm. So even if he loses, it's good for McConnell to say, well, I got as many Republicans as I could. And look, the Democrats, you know, they oppose your big priority Chamber of Commerce. I do think ultimately Republicans aren't going to be like they will not have the votes. They just will not have the votes. The game right now is winning over Democrats. And so that sort of comment, I actually don't think helps. I don't think it helps their cause very much.
All right. Well, let's move on to another topic this week.
No.
Well, there you go.
Stay
never,
on this. I've
never
been on
mind.
This for 5 fucking years.
I know. You'll get.
You're going to talk, damn it.
You're going to get another chance to talk about trade on this podcast, Zach.
It's gonna, like next week and then the week after.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
It's like the only thing that might actually happen in Congress this year. It's the only thing.
Probably. Well, thanks for ruining my transition. What a train wreck this transition has been. And that was a bad joke. Anyway, so yeah, very poor taste. That's my brand. Very poor taste. Very, very tactless nonsense that I should be ashamed of. Mm-hmm. But so this week there was a terrible train crash just outside Philadelphia. Night train, the 188, headed towards Washington, as a matter of fact, derailed. Many injuries. I believe seven people died.
Yeah.
We don't know how it came about, but we know that it happened as a result of a train speeding too fast. It was, I think, it clocked at 102 miles an hour around a curve that had a speed limit that was half that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a terrible, terrible accident. Cropped up, of course, in this is that it ties back into an overall debate about America's crumbling infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
right? Is that fair? Did crumbling infrastructure cause this accident?
Yes. I mean, well, I would say that America's infrastructure is in poor, you know, it's not doing well.
No, it's terrible.
It's terrible. And so right now, the fund for which wouldn't, I don't think, necessarily pay for something like Amtrak. I mean, Amtrak funding did just get cut in a committee hearing.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Yesterday.
That's right. The House panel.
That would have increased funding, I think.
Well, this is significant. It would have offered $825 million for this technology that's known as positive train control. Mm-hmm. NPR reported on what positive train control is. It is a GPS-based sensor system that the law is mandated be put on the entire commuter rail network. And it's actually on part of the Northeast Corridor train line. It's not... Obviously, it's not
where this crash happened. And what Positive Train Control would do is, using GPS and sensors, it detects things that are on the track and it detects the speed of the train, and it can override the engineer and actually slow the train down. This accident would not have happened had this technology been in place on this,
this
track.
This turn is like as close to a right angle turn as you can have on like a train track. It's very likely that there was some type – it's at least possible that there was some type of mechanical failure on the train, which led to it going too fast and being unable to slow down. So that is itself another problem. Like, this is a problem independently of why we don't have safety factors
right, but you know,
to prevent broken trains from crashing.
This is a point the NTSB spokeswoman on NPR emphasized, was that we don't have like a whole bunch of commuter train accidents all the time.
Mm-mm.
And it's just when one happens that all this stuff is thrown into stark relief.
Dana
Liebelson wrote a story the night of, explaining that the Amtrak system is actually quite safe.
But this is why regulation is important, right? Like the banking system was super safe until it was the most unsafe thing in the fucking world, and it destroyed the entire economy.
Right.
Like, everything was cool on Wall Street. Everybody was happy, no problems, until everything was a disaster. It's all cool on Amtrak until a train crashes.
The interesting thing about that Positive Train Control is that there's numerous regions that are going to miss their deadline on having this stuff installed. Mm-hmm. And so the money that was cut, I don't know what the money would have gone to. Presumably it could have gone to help meet deadlines.
Mm-hmm. But it would have gone to Amtrak's, yeah, and it was like $200 million or so that was cut. But yeah, I mean, the fact that commuter trains are still relatively safe. I mean, this accident did happen. But I would speak to Zach's point about just regulation is important, and it's hard to keep up with all the standards if you don't have the funds to do so.
You know, I can't help but note that in Japan, they have maglev trains that travel 300 miles an hour. In fact, just recently they set a new record from
that's terrifying.
From Tokyo to Nagoya. They got a train from Tokyo to Nagoya in 40 minutes. That's roughly about the distance between Washington, D.C. and New York City.
Oh, wow.
So they did that in 40 minutes.
But
and
you're missing the point here, Jason.
Am I missing the point?
You're missing the point. The point here is that look how good the private sector is at innovating into new types of space of travel in the United States. Just look at the private sector space industry. It's doing great. Everything there is fine. They never have any accidents. It seems to be terrific.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There were accidents. That's the irony of what Zach's talking about, you guys. There were accidents. But, you know, as someone who does like taking the train and does like taking the train, especially around the Northeast Corridor, I am kind of aggrieved that many, many other nations, including I think Uzbekistan, have bullet trains, maglev trains that are superior to ours.
I don't want to call them a problem, but you know, I mean, Congress does technically work far behind, you know, the private sector. So, or when they implement standards, then it does slow them down or the private sector down a little bit. But I think that the regulations are important because of the fact that, you know, without these regulations, then something could happen.
I'll leave it this. It's sad that it takes these kind of tragedies to focus so much energy and attention on this stuff. But, you know, this is why a forward-thinking, proactive Congress that actually wants America to succeed and wants our infrastructure to be great would be preferable to the one we have.
Which is ideologically opposed to roads.
Right. But we'll defund Acorn.
10 times.
10 times. All right. Well, guys, thanks for joining me on these two segments. Zach Carter, you can follow him on Twitter at Zach D. Carter, as we're fond of saying. It's Zach as Zach.
Yes.
Z-A-C-H-E.
H as in hammer.
C-A-R-T-E-R. Also follow him at Brutalism.
With three M's.
Brutalism.
That's true. SoundCloud.com/Brutalism.
And you can follow Laura Barone Lopez at, and I don't know your Twitter off the top of my head.
L Barone Lopez.
That's L. That's LBARRONLOPEZ.
Yes.
All right. Great. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.�
Hey there, listener of this podcast. I've got a quick little thing I'd love to chat with you about. Are you a regular So That Happened listener? Well, let us know. Send me an electronic communication with your electronic communicating devices at sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Tell us what you think of the show, what we're messing up, and who you'd like to hear more from or more about. Okay, back to the program. Okay, hi everyone. We are back, and now we are with Huffington Post's own Allie Watkins.
Hey,
that's
thanks
right.
for having me.
Yeah, totally. Say hello. Say hello when I.
You know. I haven't had coffee yet, so I'm kind of.
No, it's okay. Yeah, don't even worry about that. It's all good. And here, making his So That Happened debut, we are very excited to have Akbar Ahmed.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Yes, it's great to have you here. It's great to have you two here, because now we're going to talk about Seymour Hersh's alternate history of the Osama bin Laden killing.
Long alternate history.
Yes, and I want to tell listeners right up front that it's going to be a long conversation, and so what we've decided to do is sort of like take it in parts. We're going to have part one here today, and then tune in next week for the exciting conclusion of what the fuck just happened with the Cy Hersh piece. So see how I baited the hook for now you to come back for the this is our first like exciting cliffhanger episode. We're like Broadchurch up in this bitch. So that's great. That's great. That's great. So let's just begin at the beginning. So Seymour Hersh, celebrated journalist, celebrated NatSec foreign policy journalist. He's the guy who wrote the story on the My Lai massacre. He also most notably wrote Pathfinding reportage on Abu Ghraib. This week in the London Review of Books, published a massive opus. Essentially, it is an alternative telling of what happened that White House Correspondents' Dinner weekend so many years ago, when SEAL Team 6 capped, for the lack of a better word, Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad, Pakistan. And this is a very different story, you guys.
Very different
like,
story.
Like, super different. Like, can we just, like, talk about the ways in which this story is different right off the top?
Well, where to even begin?
I think that one of the biggest ways in which it's different is that Seymour Hersh basically turned around to everyone else who has ever reported on this and said, fuck you, you are an administration tool.
That's true, yeah.
One reason why the response has been so
intense. They didn't take that so well, did they?
Yeah. No. And you see people like Peter Bergen, for instance, who wrote a book about this raid, right? There are people who've done really deep work on this and think this is wrong. So Seymour Hersh is essentially saying, the story that glorifies American SEALs is wrong. Pakistani intelligence is a lot more involved. And the Obama administration is slippery, political, and manipulative. Mm-hmm. Which is not news, but...
Exactly. No, no.
Well, I mean, looking at the specific claims, you can go down a giant list. Where to even start? You know, it wasn't torture and this courier that led to bin Laden's compound.
Right, right.
It was some ISI defector, a high-level Pakistani intelligence official who
took 25 million.
Yeah, walked into the CIA compound and said, hey, here's where Osama bin Laden is. And Jessica Chastain goes, hey, thanks. Okay. End credits, and we're done.
Right.
Other inaccuracies.
There's a lot. A pretty big claim he makes is that the Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, was holding Osama bin Laden as a prisoner for 5 years in this, like, rather nice house in Abbottabad, which is... Abbottabad. Being around Americans makes me mispronounce my own country's name. Abbottabad, where the Pakistani version of West Point is, the military academy. Osama was living within a couple of miles of it. Seymour Hersh's claim is the ISI knew it, kept him as a prisoner. And a really interesting claim that he makes, I don't think is getting enough attention, is that Osama was not the operational commander of al-Qaeda. So he's basically saying, hey, Obama, this was not a big win. This was just an old guy who was a prisoner of the ISI who you just killed.
Right.
Whereas Osama Jesus, is like, we got the leader of Al-Qaeda, destroyed this leadership, got all these documents, and killed him in a firefight.
Right.
So that's a very different depiction.
The account of the firefight, the account of what happened the minute the SEALs entered the compound, right. Dramatically different.
Completely.
And different. To just bring it back to Jessica Chastain, I guess the scene in Zero Dark 30 is like, I'm the motherfucker who lucked into this guy walking in my front door.
Exactly.
So there's a totally different story about the firefight, what happened, totally different story about what became of the remains of Osama bin Laden after the fact, mm-hmm. and a crazy idea that there was a backroom deal cut between the United States government and Pakistani intelligence and government. There's even within Sai Hirsch's story a lot of like very conflicting things about how the SEALs felt about the mission itself. At one moment, you have Bob Gates saying, oh, I think you have to be really careful when you talk about this not to disclose methodology because the SEALs do this stuff every day and we don't want people to know about it, to the SEALs being sworn to a non-disclosure agreement, which they were presumably upset about, to two of them writing books about it in defiance of the non-disclosure agreement they were presumably upset about, and yet not dropping the dime right. on Obama in either of those accounts if Hirsch's account were true. And it's just a lot of puzzling stuff going on here.
Yeah, I mean—
But to read it, it does hang together a little bit.
Absolutely.
It's a story with a beginning, middle, and an end. Mm-hmm. The story has—
And it's a fun narrative to read. I mean, it's the sensational spy cover-up crazy story. I mean, the number one rule of covert action is you don't tell a lot of people about it. So that's probably—
Exactly.
I mean, one of the most simplistic problems just in trying to wrap your head around all this is that— You know, there's no secrets. There's only delayed disclosures. That's a mantra that I've heard consistently from people that I talk to within the IC.
Oh, and then there's the Vinson. There's the Vinson. There's the USS where they allegedly held this funeral. That's a ship full of people that apparently are all like, yeah, we'll keep it.
You know, it's
like, we're not spooks. We're not part of the agency, but we're hyped to keep this secret. It strains a little bit of credulity.
I think as Ali's saying, it's just so fun, which is great. It's a good story. But the problem is, like, Ali and I deal with this. Like, when you're sitting with a source over a drink, this is the kind of story you will hear, right? And it's like this long, drawn-out narrative, and then Ali and I will tell each other the narrative again, have some more drinks, and think, haha, we know something. This reads like something you hear at a cocktail party. Is a lot of the problem. It's a lot of, like, a retired official is like, hey, guess what I know? And
right.
Seymour Hirsch is like...
And that's one of the problems. Okay, so this story was very poorly received, and I think it was received in a lot of ways. We can get into the ways in which mm-hmm. various people received it, and Akbar Yari touched on one. It just got right up the backside of everyone who'd been telling this narrative forever. But I think that a lot of people looked at this, and they're like, wow, okay, that's an interesting story here, but here we have it all hangs on a single anonymous source mm-hmm. who is vaguely described and described in a way that doesn't really put a lot of faith in me as to him being like really present front and center of what's going on. And there's no documented evidence anywhere in the story. And that's something that's very different from previous reporting that Sai's done. Milai, tons of documentation, and he got names on the record. Mm. Same thing with Abu Ghraib. And so it does kind of read like a sort of like, you know, Mark Twain spinning a yarn about this guy getting murdered.
Right.
I kind of feel... When I read it, I'll be honest, and I had conversations with people. I had a conversation with a guy I know who was like, I noticed the Huffington Post just put the word claims in the headline. So I heard claims this happened. How come you guys aren't being more like firm, backing him up? And you know, I was like, because dude, like Rolling Stone just happened. Like honestly,
exactly.
I think we're all a little gun shy of stories that kind of like read like this.
Yeah, if I can make just one observation on this front, you know, Akbar and I had a conversation the morning after this story broke, and I think you're in a very challenging position as a reporter when something like this happens. I think particularly as people who cover intelligence and really sensitive issues, because. To oversimplify it, don't throw rocks when you live in a glass house. You know, I rely on anonymous sources for 90% of my reporting. So I think recognizing flaws in a story is really important. then again, we didn't want to go out there and pull a Max Fisher at Vox where we just said, this is all bullshit. I don't have any sources to say it's bullshit outside of spin machines, but I you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so
he like dropped like a bomb, like a ton of bricks on this. Yeah, and I was like, whoa, slow your roll, dude.
Yeah, exactly. So it's that very careful line of still being skeptical of a story. With Cy Hirsch, I mean, he even told HuffPost, he told Michael Catalaro that, you know, Of course, as a journalist, you should never take anything as straight truth. Question it. Question my reporting. Question the administration. But at the same time, you have to walk a very careful line as a reporter, especially when you are also relying on a lot of anonymous sources. So, yeah, that is a very good observation there about, you know, how to – can we say claims? I think claims is the safest way to put it in a headline.
Yeah, I know. And, like, you know, I appreciate anyone who comes up and is like, I usually rely on you guys to be less safe. But, I mean, we all remember, you know, Rolling Stone and how there's, like, that – you know, you get burned really easily.
Mm-hmm. And in Rolling Stone, I mean, they re-reported – Columbia re-reported the story, right?
Yeah.
And I think that that is one of the most productive responses people are now having. Ali and I have spoken about re-reporting elements of it. Like, other people are working on it. The Pakistani media is working on it. Pakistani outlets have got people who are trying to identify who this alleged tipster.
Oh, you had to imagine the Pakistani media was going to come out like hammer and tong at this.
Well, there were reports that the ISI put out a subtle gag order saying you can't talk about it. And that's not something I've heard confirmed. That's just something I've heard from people within the country in media that the ISI is saying don't talk about it. So you can't really do it if the ISI tells you not to because they will kill you. Like, that's not a joke. A colleague of mine was killed in suspicious circumstances. That happens. So the Pakistani media, it's tougher for them. The American media has a big onus, and that's why what NBC did on Monday night, where they went and tried to re-report part of this, I thought that was interesting and quite important. It was surprising to me that they then walked it back. They essentially said, we can confirm Seymour Hersh's claim there was a Pakistani intelligence official who gave this information to the Americans. Then the next day they said, oh, but the Americans didn't really rely that heavily on the information. Which was odd. I don't know what you guys made of that.
So, it was the one of the best non-correction corrections I think I've seen in a while.
Our big scoop is not so big.
But it's still like kind of a half-truth. So we're just not
going to... We're sorry about that.
Sorry, Cy.
Sorry we learned a thing. Stupid us for learning a thing. I do feel like it is maybe a productive response to this to go out and re-report it. But I'll point out that, like, I think Isaac Chotiner actually put that question to Cy in that rather hilarious but definitely contentious interview over at Slate. And you know, he said, I'm not taking a thing I said back, which kind of says to me that, like, yeah, people can re-report it, but he's unmoved.
Yeah, two pieces here come to mind with this. The first is, I believe it might have been Slate again. They did kind of this story, again, poking a little more fun at Hirsch's piece than I think I personally would have done, but kind of looking at this archetype of the crank intelligence source.
Yeah.
Kind of these old retired guys who you know, the nut of their knowledge is usually right, but they tend to be very conspiratorially minded. I think we've all run into sources like that. And usually if you can weed out which is relevant and what's not, they can be great avenues for good stories.
Well, some guy who fits that milieu was the guy who worked for Cheney, who gave everyone news about the raid on Twitter.
Yeah, oh, they got exactly
what they're about to say is that they got Osama bin Laden.
Yeah,
right. And didn't Dwayne the Rock Johnson also know in advance? Which is
I don't know. Maybe Dwayne the Rock Johnson.
Everyone's
was
a spook,
source.
Guys. USS Vincent.
You really never know.
Yeah,
the Rock.
We all could be in on this conspiracy. Writing for the New Republic, L. Reeve suggested that another reason that maybe the story didn't explode in the way that previous Cy Hirsch stories exploded was that it kind of like whistled past Obama's head. And so, like, the typical liberal media elites, liberal pundits were disinclined to give Hirsch a lot of credit because they're going after the guy in the white hat. So is there any credit? Do you think that plays a role in this?
I think that a lot of people were hurt, and, like, people are forgetting this, but Seymour Hersh wrote a piece in 2013 saying that Bashar al-Assad did not commit a chemical weapons attack.
That's right. He pinned it on Turkey.
Crazy.
Yes.
That was insane and so out there. And these kinds of stories, like, much as we can sit in Washington and discuss the intricacies of the reporting and, like, what were the ethics here and who did he talk to and blah, 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 these have real consequences on relationships with countries. So something like that Seymour Hersh piece on Turkey and the chemical weapons had real consequences for the Obama administration's perception of its Syria strategy and how people in the region viewed the White House.
So do you think that maybe there is some defection from ideological allies who might have like supported a Hersh story about the Bush administration, for
right.
example?
Mm-hmm. I think so. And I think also when he was wrong on that, which was really a big claim, like he had nothing to back that up and we haven't seen that go anywhere. That burns people because you're not going to turn around then and say Seymour Hersh is a great guy who's exposing amazing things.
Right. So, you know, I liked what Elle was saying in that piece, but I would have, you know, if I had anything to add to it, I would say that, like, there's a lot of reasons for people to, like, just be gun shy because of the journalism.
Yeah, exactly.
And that I think that, I mean, like I said, I think your point is right. I think that, like, I think that Max Fisher got, like, a little bit out over his skis in his response to this. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't have been that. It's been so weird, like, a lot of the vacillations has been between Cy Hersh and a guy who comes a little too hard at Cy Hersh.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, well, I keep being pushed back between these camps. And mm-hmm. so, that's why this is fascinating why we're talking about it, because, like, I'm trying to, like, find the straight line here between
yeah,
a lot
hard.
Of different truths. It's not easy. Like I told readers, we're going to have part one of this in this week's podcast, part two next week's. So that's what happened this week. This week, Ibrahim Balki is out of the office, and so Brad Shannon handled most of the producing, editing, and technical direction for this podcast. Thanks, Brad. See you soon, Ibrahim. Our efforts were assisted, as always, by Christine Canetta and Adriana Ucero. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by HuffPost reporters Akbar Ahmed, Laura Barone-Lopez, Zach Carter, and Ali Watkins. So That Happened is available on iTunes, so check us out in the iTunes store and look for the Huffington Post's whole family of podcasts. Subscribe and tell your friends. Next week, we will have the second part of our Seymour Hersh discussion, so please tune in for that. In the meantime, if there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, always you can send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Like always, we thank you very much for listening, and we miss you already.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.